Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
In the late 1960s, I wasn't even aware that Armagh had a Gaelic football team. Our neighbours down with three All-Irelands in 8 years rather outshone our lot. And my family was not particularly nationalistic either, despite my great-grandfather being a founding member of the Ulster GAA, and until 1920, hosting many of their committee meetings. Of course, we all played the game in school, but soccer was a greater attraction. And when an inter-community soccer tournament was mooted, about a year after the troubles started, me and my pals were looking forward to taking part. However, we were called in to a Christian Brothers class and told in no uncertain manner that participation in this soccer tournament would mean we would not be considered for the school's Gaelic football team in the Rice Cup. This being 1970, the ban on foreign games was still in place. For some reason, the soccer tournament never materialised. The first county match I can remember attending was at the local athletic grounds in Armagh a few years later. I wasn't terribly interested and turned up some minutes into the game. Someone told me that an Armagh player had already been sent off. His name was Joe Kernan. I hadn't a clue who he was. Some big strapping lout from Cross Maglen. I think the match was against Donegal, and I can't remember who won, but my memory is very hazy about the whole thing. Armagh had only ever reached one senior All-Ireland final. That was in 1953. They lost to Kerry by 4 points, and Bill McCurry missed a penalty. I didn't know who Bill McCurry was, but I knew he was the guy who missed the penalty against Kerry. His claim to local infamy. The fortunes of Armagh's county team were beginning to rise in the mid-1970s, and I began to take a greater interest. Unfortunately, the violence in the north was also on the rise, and by 1976, my parents had decided they had had enough. By the end of that summer, when I played for my Armagh Harps under-16 team against Cross Maglen Rangers in the juvenile county final in Carrickcruppen and won, our family had moved south to Dundalk. That was the last Gaelic football match I ever played. Armagh reached the 1977 final, and I stood among swathes of orange flag-waving supporters at the canal end of Croke Park. As the Armagh team ran out onto the pitch, it was raining. Then the rain stopped, and the Dublin team ran out. It proved somewhat prophetic, as the Dubs gave us a beating, despite that guy, Joe Kernan, scoring a brace of goals on the day. It had been 24 years since Armagh's last final appearance. It would be 25 years to the next. 2002. Third time lucky? The opponents, Kerry. As in 1953. I sat in the Cusack stand, and at half-time, Armagh, as in 53, were 4 points behind and had missed a penalty. The ghost of Bill McCurry wafted across the pitch. Some Kerry lads behind me were already offering their condolences. Meanwhile, in the Armagh dressing room, the manager, a certain Joe Kernan, was delivering an iconic half-time talk that spurred on an almighty comeback in the second half and led Oisín McConville, who had missed that earlier penalty, to carry the ghost of Bill McCurry on his classy shoulders and score the only goal of the game. Armagh won by a point. The orange eruption of emotion that greeted that final whistle was like nothing I have experienced before or since. A mountain of a man beside me kept slapping my back with his hand. I think his fingerprints are still embedded on my spine. As the tears of joy overflowed onto the pitch, orange over green, and the Armagh captain, Kieran McGeaney, geezer, raised the holy grail in the air. I myself hesitated to step on to the hallowed ground, feeling somehow unworthy, a fair-weather pilgrim. But then I thought of my great-grandfather's devotion in the early days. I thought of Bill McCurry in 53, his ghost finally laid to rest. I thought of the Christian Brother in 1970 laying down the law. I thought of my final match in Carrickcruppen and the feel of that trophy in my hands. I thought of the shower of rain in 77 and our collective yearnings drowned. And I looked at the dancing generations in front of me, lost in unthinking joy. And I thought of what these people, my people, had lived through in recent years and how much they deserved this moment. And I left the stand behind me and walked on to the grass.
I wish I was singing with McGee and Marty's girls down in Woodlawn, with the songs from home turned way up loud, the football and hurling on. Those were the days. And the night.
There it sits. All 764 metres of it rising out of the Mayo landscape. The train carriage quietens and everybody looks. It always makes me feel like I'm home, comments one of the passengers. The ascent, they add, is no joke, and one of them starts to rub the back of his legs as if to ease a remembered ache. They're half my age. I'm scared. 6 decades done, and for more than 3 of them, I've been avoiding climbing the reek. It's now or never for me with my hypermobile ankles, which sometimes give out under me without warning. My mobility is only getting worse. The deadline I've given myself for getting up that mountain is today, even if I have no idea why I'm doing it, as I don't even like walking uphill. Why do people keep wanting to climb Croagh-Patrick, I ask my guide, local archaeologist Brendan Walsh. Just look at it, he says. Very often, of course, there's nothing to see. As a friend on Inishbofin Island complained, when you can't see it, it's raining, and when you can see it, it's going to rain. But when it emerges, it's a perfect cone, always dominating the landscape, yet different from every vantage point. Why do people like conical mountains? Because they lead the eye upwards towards the heavens? Does climbing Croagh-Patrick promise transcendence, as do Fujiyama and Mount Olympus, and sacred conical mountains from the Andes to Siberia to Tanzania to China? St. Patrick, said to have fasted for 40 days and 40 nights on the summit in the year 441 AD, is in truth a latecomer to ritual practice on the mountain now called after him. Beads of white, blue and purple glass, as well as amber, which were found at the summit of the reek in the 1990s, may date back as far as the 3rd century BC. Today, Reek Sunday is still known to some as Thánach Crum, or the Sunday sacred to the pagan god Crum Cruach, probably a sun god representing fertility. Before a 15th century papal decree was discovered in the early 20th century, which changed the day of the pilgrimage to the last Sunday in July, the reek was climbed on August 15th. Many Christians celebrate the ascension of the Virgin Mary into heaven on this day, but its origins are in a festival celebrating Mother Earth, who provides the harvest. On August the 15th too, tiny Cahir Island, linked to the summit of the reek by a mythical path across the sea called Bohir na n-Iaf, or the Saint's Road, is visited by pilgrims, and Mass is said beside its ruined 7th century church. Another ancient path, this time on land, links Rathcrohan in County Roscommon to Croagh-Patrick, passing the Bohay Stone, which bears as many as 250 cup and ring markings and may be 4,000 years old. The historian Jerry Bracken intuited that the stone had a relationship with the reek. And in 1989, he discovered that the sun seems to roll down the sides of the mountain when viewed from the stone on April 18th and on August 24th, the beginning and the end of the growing season. Croagh-Patrick and its surroundings make up a huge panoramic ritual landscape, made sacred as the land has been made sacred in many traditional cultures. Think of the Anangu people in Australia, who believe that they can communicate with their ancestors just by touching Uluru. Trudging up the reek on the new path, which has just been completed, I felt that I and my fellow travellers were not seeking to transcend the land as much as to know it intimately, to become one with the landscape and therefore as immortal as it is. "I am a mountain in a man," says Emergan in one translation of his song from the 12th century Book of Leinster. "Lead out now, lead out," a father instructs his young son as they approach the summit, incanting the complex series of Our Fathers, Hail Marys and creeds which tradition dictates. And suddenly, we've made it. The wonders of Mayo and Connemara are laid out around us as on a plate. I see Inish Boffin, Inish Turk, Clare Island, Achill Island, Mulranny, Old Head, Bartra Strand, Nathan, Leenane, the Sheafries, the 12 Pins. "Take a picture, will you, and I'll take one of you," asks an elderly man from Yorkshire who's been climbing just below me. We pose by the sign saying, "Croagh-Patrick, Ireland's holy mountain." Unlike me, he's climbed it once before, he tells me. That was 63 years ago when he was on honeymoon in Ireland with his wife. She died last year. Everyone who climbs the reek today will have their own reasons. But for me, this ancient spiritual journey is not as much about transcending the earth as becoming part of it.
I arise today through the strength of heaven, light of sun, radiance of moon, splendor of fire, speed of lightning, swiftness of wind.
Johnny Weissmuller taught me how to swim. I'm talking about Tarzan of the Apes, but I must give my father some credit too. He had a lot to do with it. After I had been rescued from drowning in the river beside our home in Limerick, Dad set about teaching me how to swim. He pulled a bundle of bulrushes from the edge of the river, bound them together, and eased them across my chest and under my arms. With one mighty push and a shout, "Kick your legs!" I was swimming in the Shannon. We repeated the exercise several times until the rushes became waterlogged and sank, but I remained buoyant. I could swim. Well, I managed to stay afloat in a gasping, panting, splashing, water-swallowing way. It took no less a person than Tarzan, alias Johnny Weissmuller, to fine-tune my frantic movements into the art of swimming. I was a Tarzan fan, and luckily our neighbours, Tessie and Phyllis, worked as usherettes in the Grand Central Cinema. They slipped me into a matinee free of charge whenever I appeared in the foyer, and I drew frequently on their kindness. Sitting alone in the darkness of that cinema, as Tarzan swam in jungle rivers, I measured his arm movements and every kick of his flying feet. Whenever I saw swimmers in our nearby Abbey River, I knew exactly where they were going wrong in the new, powerful front crawl. Yes, it was Johnny Weissmuller who taught me how to swim properly. He was an Austro-Hungarian born in 1904 in what is Serbia today. There's a record of him immigrating with his parents to America and landing at Ellis Island in 1905. Having settled in Chicago, he contracted polio when he was just 9 years old, and doctors recommended swimming in order to strengthen his limbs. His dedication and determination over the next few years got him a place on the American swim team, and he travelled to the Olympics in Paris in 1924. He brought home 3 gold medals, having won the 100-metre and 400-metre individual swimming events. The third was for the 4x200-metre relay race, and there was a bronze for him with the water polo team. Back in Paris in 1928, he won a gold medal for the 100-metre freestyle and another for the 200-metre relay team event. All these achievements, his stunning good looks and amazing physique, got him into films. He was the perfect Tarzan. Thing is, when the story of Tarzan of the Apes was written by Edgar Rice Burroughs, the front crawl hadn't even been invented. Tarzan, in his time, would have been swimming something akin to breaststroke. But who cared when Johnny Weissmuller appeared with Cheetah, the chimpanzee, by his side? Every woman in the cinema swooned. Big John, as he was called, fueled my ambition to one day become an Olympic swimmer. I practiced and strutted my stuff at Corbally swimming baths until someone noticed me and I was invited to join Shannon Swimming Club. The big problem was there was no indoor swimming pool in Limerick. In winter, some of us would hitchhike to Cork and do a bit of training in the heated, chlorinated pool. Then we depended on our thumbs to get us home to Limerick again with wet heads and swollen eyes. And always in my mind, there was that ambition to make the times to represent Ireland in the Olympics. I drew on the kindness of our neighbours, the usherettes, again to watch Esther Williams in The Million Dollar Mermaid, Dangerous When Wet and other watery films. Although she never got a chance to compete for an Olympic gold, the 1942 Games were cancelled because of the war. Yet her swimming took her into films, and she not only looked gorgeous, she could swim underwater and smile without swallowing gallons. Johnny Weissmuller was smitten and wooed her for 2 whole years, but she never succumbed to his charms. My Olympic dreams ended when a dog knocked me off my bike a week before the trials. I broke my elbow. But swimming became my life. I continued my training at Corbally Baths in Limerick and became a water safety instructor. And later on, I qualified as a swimming teacher. My wonderful swimming life is all due to my dad and his bundle of rushes, Johnny Weissmuller and Esther Williams, who perfected my strokes, and of course, the usherettes at the Grand Central Cinema. Those memories are far more precious to me than any Olympic gold medal. Thank you.
swimming. This summer I might have drowned, but I held my breath and I kicked my feet and I moved my arms around. Moved my arms around. This summer I swam in the
On St. Patrick's Day 2006, I took my two young sons to Croke Park for the All-Ireland Club Finals. It turned out to be a wonderful day for Galway supporters, with Portumna winning the hurling final and Saltail and Knocknacara winning the football match. Even better than that, we were privileged to see two of Galway's greatest ever sportsmen in Croke Park on the very same day. First up was young Joe Canning, playing with his older brothers on the Portumna hurling team and getting his team off to a perfect start when he goaled after 3 minutes. He scored another 6 points in the match. Not bad for a young 17-year-old, a yamel of his time. Later in the afternoon, the Dunmore man Michael Donlan thrilled us in the club football final. Yes, it was strange watching him play for Saltail Knocknacara. This was 2006 and Michael Donlan was already a household name in Ireland. He had guided Galway to All-Ireland wins in 1998 and 2001 and had already 3 All-Stars to his name. He had originally played for Dunmore Mackails, just like his father and grandfather. In fact, the Donlans are still, to my knowledge, the only 3-generation family to have all won All-Ireland medals. Michael's grandfather Mick was part of the 1925 Galway winning team and Michael's father John captained the Galway team in 1964. Sadly, Mick Donlan died on the very day his son John lifted the Sam Maguire Cup in 1964. My own mother was from Dunmore and her brothers were all good Gaelic footballers. Back in the 1940s, they formed a team which rivalled Dunmore Mackails. They were called the Carron Trailia Slashers and were also based in Dunmore. The Slashers even beat the Mackails on a couple of occasions. My uncle Mick was well into his 70s when he died. At his funeral, a blue and yellow Slashers jersey was brought to the altar. The priest commented how they had chatted recently and my uncle Mick showed the priest the Carron Trailia Slashers shirt. You see that jersey, Father? It's got some blood on it. And you know something? It's not all my own blood. Yes, the Slashers were a hardened bunch. In Frank Ward's excellent anniversary magazine commemorating the club, there is a picture of a young John Donlan playing for the Carron Trailia Slashers in 1955 when they won the Galway North Board Junior title. Just 9 years later, the same man was lifting the Sam Maguire Cup for Galway. So getting back to the All-Ireland Club Final of 2006, I couldn't help thinking that instead of playing for Saltail Knocknacara, Michael Donlan could have transferred to the Carron Trailia Slashers, if they were still around. Imagine the Slashers playing in Croke Park. My mother and her uncles would have been so proud, and if they had won, it would have been some hell of a celebration back in Dunmore. And so we come to today's match against Armagh, and again there's a Dunmore man in the team, the Galway goalkeeper Conor Gleeson. He was the hero who scored that last minute winning point against Mayo in the Connacht final from 50 metres out. I suspect that Conor's grandfather played for the Carron Trailia Slashers, as there was a famous racehorse called Carron Trailia, owned by the Gleeson family, which won the Galway Plate in 1948. Another famous Dunmore man, Jack Mahon, played on the 1956 All-Ireland winning team. Not sure if he ever played for the Slashers. However, Jack Mahon is even more famous as a journalist. He best describes Galway's greatest and most precious win in 1998 after a 32-year wait. The turning point came early in the second half. All Galway people remember vividly what happened. The aforementioned Michael Donlan passed the ball into full forward Pádraig Joyce, now manager of the Galway team, of course. Pádraig caught the ball, rounded the goalkeeper and kicked the ball into an empty net. A few weeks later, Jack Mahon bumped into Pádraig Joyce's parents while walking on Salt Hill Prom. They were still talking about Galway's great win and that special goal. Jack pointed out to Pádraig's parents that Pádraig had great skill to be able to sidestep the goalkeeper so quickly. Straight away, Pádraig's father replied, "It was the Irish dancing. Pádraig never lost it." So looking at this 2024 Galway team, I recognise that there seems to be a quick movement, flair and sidestepping of opponents that can only be put down to one thing. Pádraig is passing on his own dancing technique to his players.
I dreamt I'd wear the jersey on All-Ireland final day, stand out there in Croke Park with the mighty part to play. We'd come out of the tunnel to a great big Galway roar. We'd have our picture taken.
In the 1940s, my grandmother, in her wisdom, sent her eldest boy, Laurie, and his younger brother, Seamus, to live with a family in the Gaeltacht. They left their home of Killeshandra in Cavan for Spittle. In addition to absorbing Irish, that summer my father started taking classes on an instrument that would become his lifelong companion, the fiddle. Once a week, that merry-hearted boy would cycle from Spittle to Galway City, a round trip of over 20 miles, to attend his fiddle classes. When he grew up, my father worked in the bank. As was the practice at that time, he was relocated every few years. My father would always become part of every town, acting in the panto, playing music in the local pubs. He had a tongue-in-cheek reputation as a fiddling bank manager. When I was 12 and we'd moved to a small town, I'd introduce myself to a neighbour, Phelan, and the new neighbour would often reply, "Phelan Brady, the Bard of Armagh," citing the Irish ballad. I'd nod my head. They'd ask if I'd heard it. I'd shake my head. It wasn't in my father's repertoire, even though he was always playing ballads and slow airs on the fiddle, and still does. My father's over 90 years of age now. He forgets things, but not the important things. He can still tune his fiddle by ear and plays music with us when we visit. He especially loves "The Town I Love So Well" by Phil Coulter, and I wonder, is he thinking of Killeshandra? Growing up, when I would draw a new picture or write a new piece of prose, my father was my first critic, not that he ever offered anything other than praise. After secondary school, I went to Wyre College, studying my passion, filmmaking. After college, I was commissioned to co-author a book of interviews with 13 eminent screenwriters. We had the delight of travelling with my great friend Declan to meet screenwriters from Dublin, LA, Poland, Japan and France. But the writer I was most excited to meet was Robert Towne. But Robert was difficult to contact. He was the author of Chinatown. He passed away earlier this month. We sent faxes to agents, the Writers Guild of America, but Robert was elusive. But to our delight, a few days before our scheduled flight to LA, we heard back from him, agreeing to the interview. Leaving a dark Dublin in November, it took a while to acclimatise to the sunshine of LA. On the day of the interview, we drove to Pacific Palisades. Schwarzenegger lived on the same street. The house was an absolute mansion. The maid advised us that Robert would meet us in the back house, a whole separate house. We were led upstairs to his study. Above his desk was a picture of a dachshund. I knew the dog's name, P.H. Vazek. That dog is part of Hollywood history, because when a script of Robert's Greystoke, Legend of Tarzan, was made into a film, he was unhappy with the result, and he took his name off the credits, instead giving it to his dog, P.H. Vazek, who became the only dog to ever receive an Oscar nomination for Best Original Screenplay. Eventually, Robert arrived, just back from a run. With his California drawl, he welcomed us. He shook Declan's hand before turning to me. "Phelim," I offered, putting out my hand. Robert's eyes softened, as though he recognized me. "Phelim Brady, the Bard of Armagh," he said. I was floored. Robert told me that he loved the ballad. I confess that, although I had heard about this song my entire life, I'd never actually heard it. Immediately, Robert went into the big house to look for the tape, insisting that I hear it. This meant losing 20 minutes of our interview time, but how could I argue? When Robert finally found the tape, he lit one of his iconic cigars and pressed play. The room filled with smoke, backlit by the LA sunshine. Even now, I can taste the dark Cuban tobacco. At a particular point in the song, he leaned over and pressed pause on the tape. I love this line. Merry-hearted boys make the best of old men. Today, I think of my dear, sweet father, his sense of fun, and the truth of these words.
To the lay of a poor Irish harper, and scorn not the strains of his old withered hand, but remember.
I wrote this for my dad, who is a passionate Galway GAA fan. Like most Toome school girls, I would invariably glow if one of the Jarlath Hogan Cup team deigned to say hello. Now, one of them is Bannister, boyishly excited, though grey, dead dancing at the winds as the Saw Doctors make hay. All-Ireland Day breakfasts over time became brunches. Fed on stories, I'm the feeder now of hope, history and hunches. I love walking through Drumcondra among the flag sellers and ticket touts. I love the talk of who will mark who and whose fitness is in doubt. A clash of colours descend in Dublin, a happy traffic jam. Orange and maroon march together, all in pursuit of Sam. 67 times Dad's been there on football final day. The passion of the Mannions, we'll watch Galway go all the way. Our vibe, our tribe, our game.
On this morning's programme, we heard Orange Over Green by Carl O'Neill, Reek Sunday by Victoria White, Olympic Goals by May Leonard, The Dunmore Carantrawla Slashers was by Jerry O'Boyle, The Merry Hearted Boys and P.H. Vazek by Phelim McDermott, and Our Vibe, Our Tribe, Our Game by Orla Mannion. The music was Sheila Denver and Barry Kerr on guitar and vocals with Those Were the Days. The Deer's Cry by Sean Davey featuring Rita Connolly on vocals. The Swimming Song by Kate and Anna McGarrigle. Maroon and White was by the Folk Footballers. And The Bard of Armagh by the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem. And Carl O'Neill's script and the song that followed it were recorded some years ago at the Project Arts Centre as part of Miscellany 50, a series celebrating 50 years of Sunday Miscellany, supported by the BAI, now Comisiún na Meán. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy. To listen back to this morning's programme, go to rte.ie/radio1/Sunday-miscellany or go to the RTE radio player.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast.
For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.